You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on perennial allergic rhinitis hosted by Med Learning Group. This three-part series is titled Bridging the Gap, Aligning Guidelines, Patient Preferences, and Clinical Practice in Perennial Allergic Rhinitis. The program is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage allergies, including allergists, immunologists, advanced practice providers, and other clinicians in both academic and community settings. In this episode, we'll be talking about the management of allergic rhinitis based on current clinical guidelines and some of the implications in clinical practice. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Amanda Michaud, practicing physician assistant with Family Allergy and Asthma Consultants in Florida. Amanda has long been involved in the management of patients with allergic rhinitis and has been an investigator on numerous research studies in adult and pediatric inflammatory conditions. And she has also participated in educational events on these conditions for many years. Amanda, great to be speaking with you today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So I just gave you a brief introduction, but introduce yourself. How long have you been a caregiver for patients with allergic rhinitis, and how did you end up becoming involved in this field?
Sure. Well, I've been practicing in allergy and immunology since 2014. Currently, I'm in Northeast Florida with a large outpatient group here in Jacksonville. I initially, after my PA training, became an emergency medicine trauma PA. And after a few years, I was in a transition moving across the country back to where my PA training was, and also decided at that time that I wanted something different. I really desired to have those long-lasting relationships with patients and felt like I could make more of a difference in their lives. And I had a lot of connections in the area, returning to where I went to school and did all of my rotations and training, and connected with some mentors and colleagues who then connected me with a really well-respected, busy private practice allergy group. And I decided to check it out. I spent a few days shadowing and just instantly fell in love with the science advances, how they spoke to and educated their patients about their chronic conditions. And I have never looked back, and I love my specialty so much, and I've been around for a lot of the advances, which has been really cool. Since then, I've been managing patients of all ages with various allergic and immunologic conditions. The one thing I always say that I love the most about my specialty is that our disease states that we treat affect every organ of the body, which I think is pretty unique. And since atopic diseases have a large genetic predisposition, we do end up building really long-term relationships with our patients because of the generations of families that we see. So that's me.
Well, great. Well, thanks for coming on board and doing this with us today. I wanted to focus today's discussion on the treatment of perennial allergic rhinitis, or PAR. What are some of the most common pharmacologic methods that you use to treat PAR today?
Yeah, so there's a lot of options today. Besides recommending the typical allergen avoidance measures and mitigation measures as best as possible, most of us recommend starting with something as basic as saline spray or saline irrigations, preferably, that can be used up to twice a day or even on a PRN basis. And those patients that walk into my office that have more persistent symptoms, our preferred agents to start with to treat their symptoms would be intranasal corticosteroids, such as, you know, fluticasone, triamcinolone, budesonide, mometasone. There are several, of course, and most of them are available OTC. Beyond that, we would start to consider a second generation oral antihistamine like fexofenadine or cetirizine, for example, or potentially adding on an intranasal antihistamine such as azelastine or olopatadine spray. Many of the patients walking into my office and the allergy clinic tend to have more severe persistent symptoms as the specialty office. And those patients tend to do very well on a combination intranasal corticosteroid plus intranasal antihistamine spray. These have actually been shown in combination to be more effective than the sprays being done separately. An example would be fluticasone, azelastine, or mometasone, olopatadine, for example. I would also like to add here that nasal spray technique is really important, and this can help not only reduce side effects but maximize the efficacy. And it's important to review that with every patient at every office visit. We know that most patients don't follow optimal technique. And so before advancing therapy to another step, it's always important to review that before going to add more pharmacological treatments, perhaps. Other things that we can, of course, use would be, you know, nasal decongestants for severe symptoms temporarily, as preferred, of course, to prevent any issues with long-term use. We could also consider adding leukotriene receptor antagonists like montelukast, especially if the patient has asthma. That tends to be where they're most effective. We almost always advise against the use of sedating first-generation antihistamines. We see a lot of patients that rely solely on those treatments before they come to us. Of course, not only with the sedation properties, but also with, especially with our older population, the possible anticholinergic effects like dry mouth, urinary retention, things like that can be very bothersome. So we tend to avoid those and use second generation antihistamines that really can be equally efficacious without those side effects. And then, of course, beyond that, if a patient remains uncontrolled, we start to consider other treatments like immunotherapy.
So it definitely sounds like there's a variety of options available. Now, with PAR, there's often two things going on. There's the inflammatory symptoms such as congestion, sinus pressure, and postnasal drip. And then there's histaminergic symptoms such as itch, sneezing, and rhinorrhea. So when you're thinking about treatment, do you tailor treatment chosen for a specific patient based on these presenting symptoms or a constellation of symptoms? Or is it more a one-size-fits-all approach for PAR?
That's a great question. The preference is definitely to tailor treatment. I find most patients that walk into my office with their bothersome symptoms, they've had them for years and have only really tried an oral antihistamine, which is often insufficient to manage their symptoms. For example, if they have a lot of the inflammatory symptoms like nasal congestion, nasal blockage, lots of sinus drainage, postnasal drip, they tend to do much better on a nasal spray like a glucocorticoid steroid spray. However, the combination with an antihistamine spray tends to be the most effective, also has rapid onset of action because of the antihistamine component. So patients love that. They can use the spray sometimes right there in the office and before they leave. If we have a sample, for example, before they leave, they're already noticing a benefit. Oral antihistamines really are just not super effective for nasal congestion, let's say, or those inflammatory symptoms. They're most effective for itching, sneezing, watery drainage, like you mentioned. And of course, we can use the antihistamine only sprays in patients that also have really mild intermittent symptoms. But my patient population tends to be more severe in the specialty clinic, and we tend to rely on multiple agents to treat their symptoms, but definitely targeted.
So we've talked about a variety of treatments and classes up to this point. So what guidelines are available to help clinicians with treatment selection for PAR?
Yeah, there are several. For us in allergy, we really rely on the College of Allergy and Academy of Allergy, or College and Quad AI Joint Task Force practice parameters. They were published in 2020, so they're definitely due for an update, and I think that is ongoing. But they really provide just awesome algorithms to guide treatment depending on the type of patient, their type of symptoms that they experience, as well as the intensity and frequency of their symptoms, like let's say intermittent and mild versus persistent and severe. Also, special considerations for various patients, like those that are pregnant, for example. The Academy of Otolaryngology and Head and Neck Surgeons also have their own guidelines for allergic rhinitis, and they're pretty similar and quite aligned with the allergy guidelines as well. So those are great resources. Just even having the picture of the algorithm to follow can be really helpful to guide clinicians in what to try for their patients.
So one thing we didn't talk much about is allergy shots. So how do you decide on allergy shots? Are they more effective than other approaches for certain patients with specific symptoms?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot that we consider there. Allergy shots, or SCIT for short, which I'll probably just call it SCIT by default, can be really effective for the right patient. We tend to consider SCIT as most beneficial for the patients who have really failed standard therapies with suboptimal improvement, as well as possibly children that have more severe persistent symptoms. In patients with like refractory disease, for example, let's say they've been on a trial of a combination of therapy, let's say two nasal sprays, an oral antihistamine, we're confirming good technique, and they still continue to suffer from symptoms, they would be a good candidate for SCIT. Also, patients who suffer from recurrent sinusitis or otitis media, they tend to do quite well as patients that have asthma, allergic asthma specifically. Patients who experience side effects from regular treatments, like let's say, excessive drowsiness, even with the non or less sedating antihistamines, they could be perhaps burdened by taking their medicine. They have too many medicines to remember to take. It's hard for them to remain compliant. They tend to do really well on SCIT as well. When we think about the patient and their allergic profile, getting them tested in the office with skin testing, for example, identifying their allergens, the patients who have really clinically relevant allergens, let's say, you know, cat exposure with cat allergy, dog exposure, dust mite exposure, those perennial allergens throughout the year, they also tend to do really, really well. And most patients can tell us, you know, hey, when I'm around this trigger, I tend to do much worse. We also start to think about it in kiddos ages 5 and up. They tend to do quite well on SCIT, and it's actually been shown to be disease modifying in those patients as well, potentially altering the progression or halting the progression to other allergic conditions like asthma. And of course, with the SCIT, we also do get pretty positive feedback from our patients. And they know that long term, this can not only improve their symptoms, but also reduce their medication burden. It's shown to be more cost effective long term. And we consider kind of the patient's quality of life, the missed school or work, the duration of their symptoms. Do they suffer for 4 to 6 weeks and kind of tough it out during the spring? Or do they really have year-round burdensome symptoms? So those are all things that play a factor in addition to logistical issues as well, commuting to our office to start SCIT and with our mandatory 30-minute wait, which is pretty standard when doing SCIT. Those are all things that we consider kind of the whole picture in these patients as well.
So I have an 8-year-old who's been on a SCIT program for, I don't know, upwards of 3 years at this point. And it is pretty tedious at first, knowing that you got to go every week and then it, you know, eventually escalates just up to monthly. But it does work. I mean, it's been amazing for her up to this point. And we have a cat and she was allergic to the cat and all these other things. So it's really helped her. Now, so we've talked about a good variety of classes and individual medications for PAR and allergic rhinitis in general. What can you tell us about some of the future options for treating patients with PAR that are currently in development?
Yeah, when I think of what's coming, the first few things that come to mind are biologic therapies, small molecule therapies, different vaccine-based immunotherapies, other immunotherapy options, like even sublingual immunotherapy, which we have a few available now that are FDA approved. There are ongoing studies with the biologic agents, especially that have shown some promise in reducing allergic rhinitis symptoms, for example, with omalizumab or lebrikizumab. And especially when used in conjunction with immunotherapy, we suspect there would be even a greater effect in these patients as well. There's just tons of innovation and ongoing developments in the world of immunotherapy in general, more quality controlled extracts that patients respond better to. Other options for immunotherapy like intralymphatic immunotherapy is being studied. I think a big focus really is that precision medicine, really targeting the treatments to the patients that are most likely to benefit from them and that personalized approach. So it's really exciting to have more options for these patients.
So you mentioned the biologics briefly. I want to tease out a little bit more about that if possible, since they're becoming more and more mainstream for a variety of different type 2 inflammatory conditions. However, at this point, none of them are approved for treating perennial allergic rhinitis, though some of them have ongoing studies. What role can they play in managing a patient with PAR, even though it would be off-label at that point?
Right. Like you mentioned, none of these are officially approved for allergic rhinitis, but currently they're utilized in patients with various other likely TH2-related inflammatory comorbidities like severe asthma, atopic dermatitis, chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis, eosinophilic esophagitis, all conditions that can coexist with allergic rhinitis. There are several different targets that we have, and each of these biologics target a specific or multiple inflammatory pathways like immunoglobulin E or IgE, interleukin 4, interleukin 13, interleukin 5, interleukin 31, TSLP or thymic stromal lymphopoietin. And since allergic rhinitis is thought to share some similar pathological mechanisms or pathways, it's suspected and plausible that these biologics could offer those patients additional benefit. Right now, we're using them in those conditions. We have several that are FDA approved, like omalizumab, dupilumab, lebrikizumab, tezepelumab, to name a few. And we're using them in those conditions for which they're approved, but they can also improve symptoms in the patients, which many of these patients have ongoing severe refractory AR as well, that are contributing to the severity of their disease that we're treating as well. So it's a really exciting era to have a potential option where we could treat the underlying condition with the secondary benefit of having improvement in their rhinitis symptoms as well.
So you're a physician assistant with your PhD in medical sciences, so essentially a doctorate in for physician assistants. But so for our advanced practice provider audience, PAs and nurse practitioners, what would you say are one or two of the most important challenges in managing these patients with perennial allergic rhinitis, and how do you overcome these challenges?
Yeah, I think first, like many chronic diseases, a large hurdle is concerns with compliance and adherence to the medication regimen or even SCIT, for example. The schedule can be pretty tedious, especially in the beginning. And often in the case of allergic rhinitis, these patients also have ongoing continuous exposure to their allergic triggers. And it can be really hard to avoid these things. I always tell patients you can't live in a bubble, but we can try to treat your symptoms. So that's definitely a hurdle. But I do think actually the biggest hurdle is the negative impact of allergic rhinitis on quality of life, which is grossly underestimated. It's not unusual for patients to come to us with years of suffering. They've had issues with their sleep, their mood, the day-to-day function and activities, miss school, miss work. On top of that, of course, possibly getting recurrent infections and just experiencing their daily symptoms. They're not doing things they want to do because of how they feel, which is affecting their quality of life. And sometimes because they're so used to how they feel, we really have to help them understand that this burden is immense. It's not normal. And we can essentially normalize the burden and help them understand that we can help control their symptoms as best we can and all the different things that we can do to help them. They don't necessarily think it's abnormal how they feel because they're so used to it, but helping them know that there are so many more safe and effective options to treat them and help them have that kind of normal quality of life again can be really impactful. But I do think that's a hurdle sometimes, that we kind of lump allergy conditions into this, perhaps this category that maybe is not as severe as other chronic conditions like diabetes or heart disease, for example, but the quality of life impact can be just as burdensome. So helping them understand that and helping them decide through, you know, shared decision making what route they want to go to improve that is a big hurdle, but also something that we overcome just by normalizing that and discussing it with them and helping them understand that we can make them feel better.
Well, thank you very much, Amanda. There's obviously been a good deal of evolution in the disease state itself and in treatment options for patients with allergic rhinitis. And I'm glad you could talk about some of them today. And thanks for all of the work you do in this area to bring the best possible care to patients with PAR and other inflammatory conditions. But that's all the time we have today. Thanks again, Amanda, for taking time out of your day to speak with us. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you'll be able to tune into other podcasts in the series. There's a total of three. This is the second of three. In the other two, we'll be exploring evaluation and workup of allergies and a few concepts in shared decision-making and multidisciplinary care. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I'd also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.